Good morning.
Happy Easter. Can you hear me at the back? Yeah, great. And before I get into the reading and the talk, I want to give you a heads up for what comes after the sermon. As quite an extreme introvert, I would just happily sit in silence for as long as you let me. But I'm learning that that doesn't work for everybody. So I've been chatting with some of my more outgoing friends. So thank you to Jen and her daughter, Emma, for their wonderful suggestions of what we might do after the talk. Emma said the last thing that she wants to do is sit in silence when she's just been silent for 15 minutes. And so she suggested that we would like to look out for one thing to keep or treasure, one thing to puzzle or ponder over or wrestle with or even disagree with, and you're very welcome to come and disagree with me, and one thing to share with someone else. And I'm putting these up there now so that you know to look out for them during the talk, and I'm putting them up before the Bible reading because it might be that it's something from the Bible passage that speaks to you and nothing to do with anything that I say. So if you and the Holy Spirit are going in a different direction and contemplating something else entirely, that's absolutely fine. So do keep an eye out for something to keep, something to puzzle over, and something to share. And do keep the Bible open or the passage open on your phone if you'd like to. I'm going to read to you John chapter 21, verse 1 to 19. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them, and they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from the shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there, with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you have just caught. Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153, but even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said, follow me. The last gathering was Easter Sunday, celebrating Jesus' resurrection. And today is both a follow-on from that and a segue back into our series about Kairos values, and we're thinking about shared life. Back in February and March, we had the joy of a few baptisms and confirmations. And we were thinking about shared life in the context of welcoming people to join the church family. And church is meant to be open and inclusive. Welcoming others is a mark of our fruitfulness. In the Old Testament, it talks about fruitfulness in terms of having lots of children, and there's a bit of a paradigm shift in the New Testament. Our fruitfulness is making lots of disciples. But that doesn't mean that anyone can come in and do exactly as they like. Welcome into the family of God means growing into the family likeness and becoming more like Jesus. And we're all growing in that respect. We're not yet perfect. So inevitably, there will be tension and friction and conflict. And I think that's a mark of diversity, not failure. So today we've got the messy subject of reconciliation. Challenging but vital for imperfect people growing into the family of God. I want to be clear from the beginning that reconciliation and forgiveness are not the same thing. In reconciliation, both people or both parties are participating and working towards restoring a relationship. Forgiveness is an inner process and it's a necessary ingredient for reconciliation. But you can forgive someone and make peace within yourself, even if they won't acknowledge their part, or if they can't or won't take part in the process. But here we have a story of reconciliation, and what can we learn from Jesus and Peter? Jesus had predicted Peter's denial, and Peter swore that it wouldn't happen. But then when Jesus was in the high priest's house, being accused and then abused, Peter got scared and denied that he'd ever known Jesus or had anything to do with him. And after Jesus' resurrection, here we see them addressing what has happened. It's reconciliation worked out in practice. And in this example, we've got perfect Jesus and imperfect Peter. And sometimes between us, it's one person who's at fault and the other person who gets hurt. But quite often, it's two people contributing. And owning our own part in something is really important. Peter's in the wrong, but both of them contribute to repairing their friendship, and how do they do it? Which it starts with Jesus making the first move. Don't know if you ever saw the TV show in the 80s, 90s, This Is Your Life. And someone was presented, it was a different person, a celebrity or an ordinary person, every week presented with a big red book, and it had a compilation of pictures and stories and memories that gave an overview of who they were as a person and how other people saw them. And I think what Jesus offers to Peter here is a kind of this is our friendship, an overview of the key moments of their time together over the last 3 years. It's a really broad view of who Peter is. When someone hurts us, it's easy to focus on the fault and forget the good stuff. Got a quote here from John Ortberg. He wrote a very funny and readable book about community called Everybody's Normal Till You Get to Know Them. Isn't that true? And writing about forgiveness, he says this. When we hold fast to unforgiveness towards another person, we tend to believe only bad things about them. We want to think of them only in terms of the hurt they have caused us. We want to forget their humanity. When we forgive each other, we begin to see more clearly. We do not ignore the hurts, but we see beyond them. We rediscover the humanity of the one who hurt us. He is no longer just an uncollected debt of pain. Keeping the whole person in view is really important for reconciliation and forgiveness. And Jesus does see Peter's humanity, and he presents him with a reminder of it in various ways. Here they are by the Sea of Galilee, and this is the same place, the same beach, where Jesus first invited Peter to be a disciple. Luke tells the story in Luke chapter 5, and there's so many parallels between this scene and that one. The disciples had had an unsuccessful night of fishing, and back at the beginning of the story, Jesus borrowed the boat to be a floating pulpit while the disciples cleaned their nets. And then Jesus tells them, just have one more try, put out into deep water, let down the nets, and they end up with this miraculous catch of fish.
And Peter falls on his knees, confronted with the holiness and power of Jesus, and says, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." And Jesus calls him anyway. And here they are again. Same beach, another unbelievable catch of fish, and another opportunity for Peter to be honest about who he is and to receive Jesus' acceptance and a new invitation, a new chapter of discipleship. There are other details too to remind Peter of his history with Jesus. The coal fire in verse 9. Mark, Luke and John all record that Peter's denial of Jesus took place beside a coal fire in the high priest's courtyard. And then there's the freshly baked bread in verse 9 and 13. Jesus serves it to them just as he did at the Last Supper. Smell can be something very powerfully evocative. And I wonder what memories the smell of fire and bread stirred up for Peter. Here Jesus is mixing the reminder of Peter's denial with Jesus' own symbol for rescue and forgiveness. Desmond and Mpho Tutu have written a very helpful and challenging book, The Book of Forgiving. If anyone wants to look, I've got it here. And I've got a quote from that as well. "Jesus Christ sets the pattern for reconciliation and forgiveness. Jesus, the Son of God, could erase the signs of leprosy, heal those broken in body, mind, or spirit, and restore sight to the blind. He must also have been able to obliterate the signs of the torture and death he endured. But he chose not to erase that evidence. After the resurrection, he appeared to his disciples. In most instances, he showed them his wounds and his scars. This is what healing demands. Behaviour that is hurtful, shameful, abusive, or demeaning must be brought into the fierce light of truth. And truth can be brutal. In fact, truth can exacerbate the hurt. It might make things worse. But if we want real forgiveness and real healing, we must face the real injury." I love how Jesus opens up the conversation. He sets the scene while barely saying a word. And yet there's no sweeping under the carpet here. Their history, their meeting, Peter's denial, and Jesus' offer of forgiveness are all symbolised in the scene by the bread and the fish and the wood smoke. But there's no hostile confrontation either. Communicating clearly but gently is a skill that can really help reconciliation. Sometimes we might need to be more direct if the other person doesn't understand why we're hurt or upset. No need for that here, because Peter knows exactly what he's done. And if you don't feel ready for that gentle but direct conversation, maybe the place to start is praying for the other person. I lived for many years in a Christian community up in the Dales, and we all lived and worked together and ran a retreat house. Life there was very structured. Many, many good things, lots of eating and praying, but often your day was kind of timetabled from dawn till dusk. And I've got to admit that it was on more than one occasion I had just had enough of people and I bunked off something I was supposed to be at because I just wanted a bit of space. I wrote this story out, I put so many excuses in it, but basically I just didn't want to, so I didn't do it. And there was one time I was supposed to be at a gathering one evening and I did not go. And the next morning I was in chapel setting up for morning prayer and my lovely next door neighbour, Alison, came up to me and said, "Are you all right?" And I said a slightly defensive yes, because I took her, "Are you all right?" to mean, "Where were you yesterday?" And all she did was put her arm around my shoulders and say, "We did miss you last night." And that actually moved me to tears, because if she'd come at me and said, "You know, where were you? You should have been there," I would have got defensive. But that gesture, the "We did miss you," showed me that she valued me and our friendship over and above being right. And I think however direct or indirect you need to be with someone, prioritising the person and the relationship is the key thing for reconciliation. So Jesus has issued this wordless invitation to repair the relationship. And what is Peter's response? It says, "The disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It's the Lord.' And as soon as Simon Peter heard him say, 'It is the Lord,' he wrapped his outer garment around him," for he had taken it off, "and jumped into the water. And the other disciples followed in the boat." Peter is so eager to get to Jesus, and I find this both kind of poignant and funny, that he gets dressed and then jumps into the water and swims to the shore. And I just wonder if this is shame. It's kind of an instinct to cover himself up because he knows he's in the wrong, and yet he really wants to come to Jesus and to sort things out. And as I imagine that scene, I imagine that kind of that eagerness and the reluctance battling, and bold Peter, courage wins, and he chooses to do the brave thing. And he moves towards a potentially really awkward encounter. C.S. Lewis tells us that to love is vulnerable. And this is a quote from his book, The Four Loves. To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable. Jesus and Peter both know this. To love is to be vulnerable. Relationship is a risky business. And yet they value their friendship enough to risk trying to repair it. They share breakfast and then they have a conversation. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." What we miss in the English translation of this is that there are two different Greek words used for love. And I think I've got a slide to show that. There's agape, which means self-sacrificing love, and phileo, which means brotherly love. And twice Jesus asks, "Would you sacrifice yourself for me?" And twice Peter replies, "I love you like a brother." And then on the third time, Jesus asks, "Do you love me like a brother?" And Peter affirms that he does. Before Jesus is crucified, at the Last Supper, Jesus commands that self-sacrificing love. He says in John 13, "A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this, everyone will know you are my disciples, if you love one another." And that's all agape, that's all that command to self-sacrificing love. And in return, that's what Peter promises to give Jesus. Jesus says to Peter, "You're going to deny me three times." And Peter says, "No way," and refutes those predictions of denial recorded in all four Gospels. He says, "I will lay down my life for you. Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death." But Peter does not live up to those promises. And now, humbled and realistic about who he is, he offers Jesus brotherly love. And that's honest. It's the best he feels able to give in the moment. And Jesus accepts it. And here's how Jesus ends the conversation. He says to Peter, "I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." That seems a bit strange at first, even harsh. I don't really want to know how I'm going to die, especially not if it's going to be violent. It doesn't sound very encouraging, does it? Peter died in around 64, somewhere between 64 and 67 AD, and John's gospel was probably written later. So John's writing, knowing, very likely knowing how and when Peter had died. And bearing that in mind, perhaps we can read this as a tribute or an assurance of who Peter will become, rather than a gruesome prediction. Jesus reinstated Peter, accepted the love that Peter felt able to offer. Jesus, the Good Shepherd, invited Peter to be a shepherd. And through leading the church, through risking the vulnerability of loving, through sharing his life with others in community, Peter grew to be the kind of man who could live up to the promises he'd made and lay down his life for Jesus. Peter learned what it meant to follow Jesus through reconciliation, forgiveness, love, and laying down his life. What would it look like for us to respond to Jesus' invitation as well? Jesus says, follow me.